I think we want to add two kind of basic headers. One is that there is a permanent emotional tension between the individual and the group, between autonomy and group membership. This is the Necker Cube, hopelessly committed to both. And that groups require structure to help them manage that tension, that there's lots and lots and lots of different kinds of structure, but that the need for structure, even for groups that don't have external enemies, is defensive, because groups are also defending themselves from themselves, both from their own members and also from the tendency of the group to go off the rails. I think you can imagine going to a class or being in a meeting where every individual has fun, but nothing actually happens. Right? In that case, the individuals have been satisfied, but the group function has not been advanced. Group requires structure to get over that problem. And the other thing we'll add to our list is that there is a permanent standing economic tension between individuals and groups. Because inasmuch as the group is brought together to create some value that the individuals can't, there's the possibility always of social loafing, doing less than your share and still gaining the equivalent rewards. That we need structure to deal with that as well, and that the problem becomes more difficult as the size of the group grows. So now, turning our attention to the two more economic bits of argument. The Axelrod, which we didn't get to from last week, for which I issued an apology last week about the tit for the not having gone through the tit for tat argument. The prisoner's dilemma is this. Let's say you and I stole a car. Things got a little rowdy, Tina. We get out on the streets at 3 in the morning and say, hey, wouldn't it be fun to steal a car? I think, yeah, we're in a holiday mood, we steal a car, we'll come back 15 minutes later because we don't know what we're doing, and we're taken into separate cells and interrogated. And the thing the police want to know is, who should we blame here? Right? We've got two possibilities. We're in separate rooms, we can't commit to it. I can say, Your Honor, I've never seen that person before in my life, and I have no idea who stole that car. Right? And if you say the same thing, we'll get in some trouble, but not such terrible trouble. If I say, look, it was really them, and I'll help you convict them, right, then I've maybe got a leg up on them. Except, if you say that same thing to me, then we're really both sunk. The best possible outcome for me is if I offer to rat on you, the police take me up on it, and you, on the other hand, play dumb. I have no idea how that car got through the plate glass window. Right? The worst outcome for me is if I instead want to cooperate with you, cooperating meaning us having the same story, and you say, I have no idea what's going on, and you try and turn me in. Right? That's the worst situation for me. So those payouts, this is the prisoner's dilemma major. You can see that C is cooperative. If you and I cooperate with one another, we both suffer a little, -1 in some notional punishment, a month in jail, $1,000 fine.
A lot of times it's zero, too, right?
What's that?
A lot of times they just
match. It could be zero. I mean, yeah. What really matters here is the gradient.
Yeah. Right?
And so it's the differential between these boxes. So here...
I think that particular iteration might produce slightly different results.
What's that?
Like, the traditional one, I think, is a flat zero.
There's always a slight negative on double cooperating. So there's always some risk of cooperating. It's been shown to work even when it's zero up in the box. The key thing here is the gradient, right? If both you and I try and turn each other in, we both suffer a lot. If both you and I cooperate with one another, we both suffer a lot. If we both try and turn each other in, we both suffer a lot. And if that was the only choice, it would be clear that we would cooperate. But the interesting payoff is here, where if you defect on me but I cooperate, you get a reward and I suffer seriously, and if the situation is reversed, I get a reward and you suffer seriously. And the question Axelrod asked himself was, what should you do in that situation? And the answer is really interesting. There is no answer, right? There is no strategy to pursue here. Because the circular strategy is, the least bad thing is if you and I cooperate. And you'll know that that's the least bad thing. You'll know that that's the least bad thing to do. But you also know that if I cooperate, you can actually get a reward. So then you're going to want to defect. But if I suspect that you're going to defect, I don't want to get the most harsh punishment, so then I'm going to defect. But if we're both going to defect, we're going to suffer more, and so it just goes around in circles for each participant. I think that there's a real-world example from the Princess Bride movie about which side is the Iocane pad on, right? And there is no answer. There's that, or like playing rock, scissors, paper. There's outcomes, but there's no strategy. The next thing Axelrod did say is, what if the situation is iterated? What if you play the same game of Prisoner's Dilemma over and over again against the same person? That's when things get interesting, because at that point, you open the thinnest possible one-bit communication channel. This is literally the theoretically smallest possible communication channel, which is every outcome, I understand from you whether or not you cooperated or defected, and you you understand whether I cooperated. And so if there is some number of iterations, you can imagine any strategy, and you can write this as a program, and it's been done hundreds, possibly millions of times, but certainly hundreds of thousands of times. And the program can have any strategy to produce a zero or a one. And the only external information it has is, what has the program I'm talking to produced as its output previously? Its last output and its historical output. Right. So if a zero is cooperation and one is defect, you can imagine just writing something deterministic, like just alternate between zero and one. You can imagine doing something random, which never repeats itself. But you can also imagine responding to what the other participant does. And what Axelrod found was that if you add up at the end of the game the cumulative score, nothing outperforms the program called tit for tat. The tit for tat is essentially offer to cooperate and see what your opponent does, or your partner, or whatever. Your opponent defects, defect on them in the next round, whatever else they do. If they defect again, defect again. But if they cooperate, cooperate the next. So it's essentially biased towards cooperation. But if you cross me, I'll cross you immediately and right after that. And the astonishing thing was that there was no program that was able to outperform tit for tat, no matter how sophisticated the outcome.
And this was like all in the context of like a large open contest that he actually ran.
No, the large open contest came later. And that's actually the part I want to talk about next. That's where really the assigned reading came from. This is really just head-to-head right now.
No, but that's how it evolved, was Axelrod actually held.
Oh, I'm sorry. You're not thinking about an open contest in terms of a field, a group of competitions. Right. No, that's right. Tit for tat versus all these other...
And so, like, other people were writing their own algorithms and submitting them, like, to this thing to discover the optimal Prisoner's Dilemma strategy.
So you can see here, I mean, first of all, the thing we care about socially is... There's no strategy there. There's no strategy in a one-round game of Prisoner's Dilemma. And you can see the ramifications for social capital, right? If I'm never going to see you again, you're never going to see me again. I remember seeing this illustrated extremely vividly in the Canal Street, the entrance of the Canal Street subway, where someone had bought an answering machine back when those were expensive and desirable places, off of the street vendor. The box had been opened. The corner had been opened, and inside were sitting two Manhattan phone books to give it the approximate heft of an answering machine. And the box had clearly been flung into the corner with some force. And you could tell that what the person had done was run up the stairs to try and get his money back. So that was a game of Prisoner's Dilemma where the purchaser of the box had been defective. Now, if he paid counterfeit money for it, he'd be good, right? Because he hadn't won, but he hadn't lost anything. Right? So that's the zero iteration strategy. And a lot of social dilemmas are, how do you get out of a non-iterated game of tit for tat? eBay, buying things with credit cards. There's places where you add structure so the individual transaction, I'm never going to see you again. I'm going to buy your Smurfs. We're never going to do business again. Right? How do I trust you? Right? Almost all of eBay is an attempt to answer this one problem.
That, however, is transactional. So that's the background for what we care about in here, which is the spread of strategies. So what Axelrod also found, when he set up a field of strategies, and had them compete. So this was a series of meanings set with the strategy of always defend. Right? You could just put this network here and it would sink of its own. It would just all be mean to each other all the time. Negative eight. Right? If you put one tit for tat in the middle, that tit for tat can defend itself, or doesn't do any worse, because what happens to a tit for tat strategy in a field of meanings?
It becomes a meaning.
It becomes a meaning, right? Everybody's always defecting against it, so it's always defecting against everybody else. It may offer one sort of opening round of cooperation, and then after that, its strategy is effectively mine. But the thing that Axelrod found is that if you get a small group of these things, the amount of internal cooperation, even in a group, and you assume that everybody iterates, you know, with their adjacent partners every round, the internal group creates so much value of cooperating, even for small groups, that even if they're surrounded by a field of utter hostility, they can still outperform. And that the size of the group can be very, very small. Like, if you did the diagonals, two or three tit for tats cooperating could outperform the network as a whole because they were building up enough value, even if they were in a situation where the network as a whole was almost literally conspiring against them, or at least lashing out in the way they could. Then when the strategy was changed so that if you got enough points, your strategy would migrate, right? If the delta between the value developed at this node and this node meant that this node flipped green, you can actually see a cooperating strategy spread through the network. So, yes.
It's kind of a beautiful metaphor. Are its applications actually real?
Its applications have turned out to be remarkably robust. One of the points he makes is that tit for tat, it's one of the simplest possible observable strategies, meaning that there is some predictable there's some predictable reaction from you. So I know what it is you're going to be doing, then I have a choice to participate with you or not, but I don't have a choice of opting out of the system. So one of the examples where you can see this at work is in eBay. Right. And eBay solves the prisoner's dilemma problem by doing this. Right. Here's A, here's B. Right. If I'm buying Smurfs from you, right, I'm gonna mail you a rubber check, and you're gonna send me phony Smurfs, and we're not gonna be any better off than the guy buying the phone. But there's a second transaction, right? There's this transaction, but there's also this transaction. Right. If I defect against eBay, what's eBay going to do to me?
Cut you off.
Give you a bad rap.
Just going to get a bad reputation. Right. So eBay augments the direct transition with the cooperative one. Right. So I have an iterated transaction with eBay, and so do you. So if I get a bad reputation, it wrecks my ability. I can defect anytime I like at eBay. There's actually zero protection against fraud, almost zero protection against fraud on eBay. You can set things up for escrow, but people mostly don't. And they mostly don't, because I only get to do this one time before I get some negative karma.
That's right. Not, I mean, there is, I saw some, what was it? There was some eBay account, and it was a college bookseller, and they had done like 100,000 transactions or something, and then just stopped. And because eBay gives you like a little percentage, it took, like, they got like 2 or 3 months of like just fake transactions going.
That's absurd. Right, if you can build up a reputation over a long time.
Yeah, and then there's like the classic scam is just you sell 100, like, you know, so you got 100 comic books and sell them all for 50 cents and then get a good reputation and sell one big item and flip it.
$5,000 and then, right, so there's still system gaming. The other problem is if there's structural biases here, he brings up the idea of always defect against people lower, if there's some status, right, always defect against people lower, always cooperate higher. Those systems can be stable without being optimal. So this doesn't mean goodness spreads through the world like oil. What it does mean is that situations where actors who are equally able to reach one another and who have fairly observable strategies, cooperators will do better than defectors. It doesn't mean you can ever get completely out from under defection. It means you can make it much more robust, as with eBay. And getting to this initial state, right, getting to, say, a classless society of participating co-equals, that's a big precursor step. So it shows up as a design principle if you can create that kind of field. If you have things like class divisions, defect below, cooperate above, those can still remain stable because they're very difficult to defend against. So it does a very good job of describing the situation it sits in, but the situation itself is relatively rare. eBay had a chance to essentially create it from scratch, and have done a job where they minimize fraud to the point where eBay doesn't collapse, but they haven't minimized it to zero. That is, you can still do, there are still reputation hacking.
And the assumption is that eBay has a tit-for-tat strategy as a participant.
eBay has a tit-for-tat strategy in that it is an iterative game of the prisoner's dilemma. You would like to engage in transactions on eBay and get all of the value and produce none of the money. eBay, on the other hand, would like to take all your money and give you none of it back.
There's also like this very historical importance to Axelrod's research, because Prisoner's Dilemma up to that point was used a lot in wargaming, like Rand Corporation, like popularized it essentially because when you do these sort of games with humans, they never want to drop nuclear bombs, and so they actually developed, like, or pushed Prisoner's Dilemma further than like the creators actually cared about it, because they could create these programs that would drop nuclear bombs and then they could sell more nuclear weapon systems to the Air Force. I mean, it's pretty nasty stuff. Like, in the end, it was like this whole Cold War paranoia going on. And the Prisoner's Dilemma was like part of their strategy.
Way of thinking about the game theoretical aspects of it. So eBay's strategy is essentially, if you were a user in good standing, and eBay's payoff matrix is slightly different because iterated transactions that actually have the same good, they have more good, right? Done 100 transactions, always rated very highly, that's more good than doing 10 transactions. There have been several studies that show eBay sellers who have high ratings get higher prices for the same goods because you're taking the risk premium lower. So eBay's iterative strategy is, no matter who you're buying and selling from, you're always doing business with eBay, and if you defect against us, we're going to provide the mechanism for iterating feedback, even though you may never do business with the same other person again. And that holds eBay reputation market together.
I'm just looking at this structure, and it's kind of like this vicious circle as well, because once all the reds become green, then you again the whole system becomes institutionalized, and then you have to create again a kind of like a smaller group to spread
out. Not really. I actually played an actual game, like networked game of it, like a few years ago for like a study. And it was like, and I knew tit for tat at the time, so I walked in and I was like, all right, this is how I make the most money in here. But like within like, you know, like 20 minutes, like it was just nobody defected ever, because you make more money,
right?
Like, cooperating.
Right. The interesting thing about this game is,
until the awareness.
No, it doesn't. That's the thing with
tit
for tat.
So the issue, and tit for tat is what's called an evolutionarily stable strategy, which is, it is a strategy that's difficult to dislodge even if people know that's what your strategy is. That's one of the other reasons tit for tat does well, is you don't have to hide it. In fact, it works better if you know, I'll play nicely with you until you cross me, which one I'm going to cross you back one time, and then we're just going to reset.
But there is a reset.
Yeah, but there's no value to like being the defector, even in a field where everyone's playing tit for tat. There's no economic value unless you happen to know
but
this is the last round.
But you always need that round. Tension. That's what I would say.
That
unless that's tension, you don't have that.
So the payoff matrix, and this gets at one question: how real world is this? The payoff matrix includes
the payoff matrix is fairly invisible, right? There's no sort of system game because it's clear to everybody what's going on and all that. But if we had a game that went for exactly 100 rounds, what would you do in the 99th round?
Wow.
You know where the game ends, right? In a way, the bottom of the game is also a chance to defect and get over on somebody.
Well, you can't play tip or tap, but it's still, it's basically back to a one-round game.
Right. And so if you know when the game ends, one of the things you really want is iterated transactions with no ending. Because if you know when it ends, you're going to be tempted to defect there.
This would be the point, too, that it would be interesting to make an equation between that and a pyramid scheme.
Yes, that's interesting.
Right, the pyramid scheme relies on you... Not only you not defected to getting people from you, the prudent to not defect on you. And of course, the first defector actually causes a ripple through the system. It's a different payoff matrix.
But if we say in advance, the scheme is a scheme only because it presents itself as an infinite pyramid. But if we say. Okay, this pyramid.
Oh, right, yeah, this pyramid game is going to end at.
Yeah, at 100.
That's interesting.
That's right.
Yeah, if you knew when the pyramid scheme was ending, you would apply it.
Unless you're right at the beginning.
Unless you're the first one in.
Right. If you knew it was going to end up from under you, I guess is what I mean. If you knew that you weren't going to, what is it, passenger, co-pilot, pilot, those helicopter, you know, the three-tier schemes. If you knew that you were signing on as a passenger, the game was ending in one round.
What's the point?
You've not get it that there. But so Axelrod's I think one of the structural issues of governance that we're talking about with both the coast and the buyer, which is that other people understanding what the rules are creates value, and cooperating individuals, even operating a hostile network, can create value for one another. This is a little bit like the conversation we're having about weak and strong groups, where external recognition, right? If you're in a group of all defectors, you can't tell tit from tat from the other strategist because they always defect. If you're in a group of all cooperators, you can't tell if tit for tat is anything but a pure cooperator. But the minute you introduce variable strategies, the tit for tat strategies start to show up and can actually start to create value for them. So last bit of digesting the brief. Is the coast, and probably certainly one of the most famous questions in all of economics, which is, if the market is such a great thing, why do we have companies at all?
Well, except that most people try and avoid it.
Right, but I mean, the market is so theoretically good.
Yeah, but I mean, it's interesting, like Coase, even now, he's still alive, and he teaches at the University of Chicago, but he's in the law school, because the economics department doesn't want to deal with these kind of things.
Right, but he's what's the group effect that he puts his finger on? Why are companies the size they are?
Well, I don't necessarily agree with him, but his essential thing is that there's a point where the transaction cost of you know, exchanging information and figuring out how to do certain things is easier inside a group organization than it is than doing it on the market.
What goes into transaction cost? What makes a transaction cost high? If you have to exchange information with somebody, what's the issue there? We talked about this a little bit with the lounge versus the firmware lab. Right, there's different transaction costs in the lounge than the firmware lab for finding a piece of information.
You mean what's at stake?
Yeah, like say you're a car company. And like you want to build cars, you could buy all the parts in the market and just put them together. Or maybe you could, you know, build your own steering wheels or something and create an organization to build steering wheels. And, you know, it's like you have to locate a steering wheel manufacturer, which takes time. You have to ship the goods. They might not be where you want them located. It might take them 5 days to get there when your system really needs them to be there in three or whatever it is. There's a whole set of costs of negotiating and figuring it out. And implementing it, and then working in trust with them.
Why don't I just sit in the lounge and answer questions when people come by? It works well for transfer of information. We've already said that.
Well, I think we're going back to the efficiency versus effectiveness issue. Yeah. It's effective in conveying information, but it's not efficient at all because.
Right. So Coase's argument is
that there's value in, I mean, he's principally concerned with the firm, but it's true of almost any institution, that there's value in being able to direct communication, right? This group will assemble Fridays at 12:30. Because that's more effective than every week us emailing one another and saying, hey, do you guys want to get together with me this week? Are you free on Fridays? And, you know, the standing value of the organization lowers the transaction cost of our getting together and having this conversation. One of the interesting things, which we'll start talking about more next week, is the internet has radically lowered transaction costs for group effects. So what previously was achievable only by institutions is now starting to be achieved by groups that are not institutions. The existence of the Linux operating system, for example, isn't possible in the work Coase is describing, because only a firm like Microsoft can marshal the overhead to cause a group of several hundred programmers to sit down and create an operating system. Now we have something where a group of several thousand programmers has not sat down, belongs to no coordinating institution, and still has created an operating system. And that's a really, that's a new kind of economic effect that has to do with the transaction cost behind the construction group effort. An example I often use is the Mermaid Parade. You know, there's every first Saturday of every summer, Coney Island has the Mermaid Parade, which is sort of a costume parade for hipster New York. So people get all dolled up and go down and march around in absurd costumes. And hundreds of people, thousands, tens of thousands, I think, turn out to watch. They just march around Coney Island. I think this year there were some hundred and some odd sort of individuals or groups going around the parade, and then the streets are just lined all the way around. And on Flickr for the first time, under the tag Mermaid Parade, there's a huge number of photos. Right? Hundreds of photographers, thousands of photos. There's no institution in the world who says it's so important that Mermaid Parade photos be aggregated that we'll either spend our money to do it, right? We can't make a profit. So no for-profit company's got to touch it. And there's no not-for-profit institution or government who says our citizens must be provisioned with photos of roller skating mermaids. Right? So they don't do it. And yet there the photos are. Right? And they're there because the transaction costs have been lowered to the point where the ability to collate the work of that group without requiring the kind of coaxing and invention is enabling the creation of products that didn't used to exist. So I mean, Abe said I don't necessarily agree with him. I want to be clear that is true of all the readings in this class. I do not want anything to come off here as gospel. In fact, what we've been doing the last few weeks is building up a set of problems that we'll have to look at through the lens of what difference does technology make. In some cases, minor differences. In some cases, quite fundamental. But in this case, the transaction cost is a lot of what keeps groups from creating value, and the transaction costs have fallen radically for groups. Questions about that?
So I don't understand the mermaid parade. How is it a transaction cost in the mermaid? Like,
it would be a transaction cost if you went to those photographers in advance. You said, we want to coordinate your photos and make them available because we're Acme Mermaid Photo Corp. Right? How do I make my money back? Not enough people are going to look at it for me to be able to charge the ad revenues necessary to even send the people out into the street to coordinate the amateurs. So the transaction cost of doing the coordination in advance, right? If the government Department of Mermaids goes out and says, oh, you know, we definitely need documentation so we can show that we're doing our job, right? There is no government Department of Mermaids. So there's not going to be any money allocated to that. So if you wanted to, as a goal, coordinate hundreds of photographers and thousands of photos, it would cost you some money. But what Flickr does is it reduces the transaction cost, so there's no advanced coordination required. The photos just coalesce around the individual effort of tagging and uploading and tagging. So the photo pool is created without there needing to be an institutional sponsor. Flickr is it's sort of the platformization of organization. Flickr is a platform on which things can be organized. But Stuart and Katarina don't sit around thinking, well, what should people be taking pictures of? Somebody decided, let's take pictures of circles inside squares. Right? And now that's a huge group, but nobody specified in advance, and no institution has that as a goal. So that's the transaction cost argument, is the coordination among the people happens as a side effect of the platform operating, rather than because anybody set out in advance. So we'll change gears and turn this over to Mr. Jones. We're at the cusp of, and will next class, although not next week, I'll remind you that next week we are not meeting. We are next class going to take up the issue of effects of technology. We've talked about some of them here ad hoc, but now we're going to turn our attention to that. And so, with that as background, I'll turn it over to Matt to talk about whatever.
Hello. I'm Matt Jones. I work for Nokia Design now. I previously worked for corporate strategy in Nokia as a kind of, we were sort of the experimental wing of corporate strategy, if you like. We sort of made things rather than talking about them because we couldn't find ways to talk about them. And I'm going to talk about a couple of bits of that. I think they, when we were having a little break, I was talking with Clay a little bit about how this would have some relevance to what we've been talking about. And the only way I can do that is through the lens of what I've been looking at for the last year and a half, which is Clay. And I warn you that if you start looking into, and you may have been looking into, the literature around play and social play particularly, you cannot stop seeing it in everything. It takes your life away. It's like crack. You'll start living in a role-playing game or board game shop, asking for money and food from passers-by in order that you can study play. Can I show things?
Yeah, sure.
You're going to put this up? Connector in this one?
Yeah.
So, as I say, the group that I work for has now become part of Nokia Design, and the part we're now called...
Can you see if that's on?
We're now called Network Experiences. And so that means that we're looking at, Nokia Design is for industrial designers, for UI designers. But the bit that we're looking at is what happens when you actually connect these things together. And the thing that I've been looking at is what happens when play is a major way that these things connect together. So one thing that, to try and bridge these two dialogues, when we're talking about Axelrod's work and tit for tat, tit for tat and the reason that, game theory, obviously, one of the things that about play is that you take this tit for tat play and this way of doing it into a place where it's simulated and there isn't serious outcome. And when we were talking about the effect that architecture and space has on that, that's my background is architecture. And in terms of the sorts of spaces that architects create to lessen the impact of difficult discussions or difficult interactions, often a lot of the cues that they take are about creating places which are safer, creating places where there is visibility, where you can see what strategies people are pursuing in that space very easily. So, all of a bit of I've confused myself, and hopefully I've confused you into thinking that this next 5 or 10 minutes will have value. So, I'll continue.
Like function F4.
Can you FN it to
show? Oh, I FN it
to show the second screen.
I'm easily FN'd. Talking about the economic costs and some costs. People who did sync money into creating pictures which other people would pay lots of money for and still do are stock photography agencies. The Getty ones and, you know, the Magnums and this, that, and the other, because you have art directors going, oh, I need to show pain and loss and bagels. And, you know, no one has ever done that before except for the person who said, you know, has probably predict trends or psychologists. Right, okay, we need to send five photographers out to Guatemala to illustrate the effects of pastries on family belongingness, because somebody will buy that. And just in terms of your Acme Mermaid company and the effect of Flickr, because what I tend to do, and also as a creative process in doing things, is I go to Flickr to find stuff, and you find things which are Creative Commons license, and you will find bagels, family loss, and Guatemala generally, if it gets big enough, I suppose. So interesting to think about what's going to happen to stock photo agencies. So a lot of this is to present to people inside of Nokia who don't have the first thought or reason why, in the first place, I should be employed, and secondly, why I should be employed to do this. So forgive me if you know a lot of this or take it as read, but it's just the fact we were talking about human fundamentals and investigating human fundamentals. Play is even a non-human fundamental. It's mammalian. We do every. It's in all cultures, and it's in many, many species. It's totally instinctive, and it's very hard to resist. It's a human need which we were looking. You know, this is to basically prove the point that, you know, give me some money to do this. You know, to every place. So. The research that we did, and I went through this, we did research in New York City, and we also did it in Shanghai, which was, we did two types of research. We did kind of very explicit asking people's questions stuff. We also did the more ethnographic observation research. And the basic hunch that play is on the rise in society as a social form was verified, but it was also the polarization of using play was very clear as well. And that's kind of interesting in terms of talking about social facts, I think, is we particularly found in your fair country that there is a really high polarization between players and non-players. Conservatism, as the research agent said, having risk play you rather than you playing with risk. So the attitude towards risk being a withdrawal from interaction, from putting yourself out there in the first place. And then the players who play with risk and embrace uncertainty, go through that first iteration, see what happens, and then also kind of move on from those strategies. There's also, just in terms of what we found, and coming back to the spatial element again, is there is a greater concentration or observable concentration of players in cities, in certain types of cities, pedestrian cities, observable cities, some work that I'm doing right now is with a group in the Bartlett School of Architecture in the UK in London. And who are called Space Syntax, and they employ a methodology called Space Syntax to understand. They use it to simulate how cities and buildings are going to be played, and where they charge lots of money to consult on the design of shopping malls to see where the footfall is going to be, to see where people are going to go, to see where the social interaction is going to be, and they do it with this quite deterministic model, which is about lines of sight. And there's something about using lines of sight and Axelrod stuff which I can't quite get to, but anyway, let it go. This quote I like is it's hard to feel you've reached the point in the world where you've passed. It's hard to feel you've reached the point where you've mastered the world. I feel sorry for people who don't play because they're left in the dark so much. Whether it's seeing their city and working how that joins up, or releasing what their technology around them could be useful by themselves. So this is a quote from somebody in Shanghai, I believe, actually. One of the things about the two other things that we sort of talked about in the structure that came up to this was that the rise of play is both generational and it's cultural. So there's a book by John C. Beck called God Game, which is a little bit Newsweek friendly, but its point is that the media that people are using is shaping their attitude towards play, and shaping their attitude towards iterating social situations. So people who are graduating business school now who have been gamers are acting in very different ways, and the people who have had, the HR people are having problems with this in some ways. So it's kind of, it's coming from evidence rather than hypothesis around play, which is kind of interesting. It's kind of, the HR departments and big corporations who go and employ MBA people have had these games in the HR departments, which have been used to create organizational rules or organizational culture in certain ways, which are getting played and gamed by the gamers in turn. And this generational change is all to do with the technology and media of play that people have had access to over the last 15 years, 10 years. Just going to go through a couple of the trends which might be interesting. I don't know if they're directly related to what you're talking about, but I'll whip through them. This one occurs through and through, and you probably, this is, sorry if this is all very patronizing and obvious, but the solidification of social networks, to reduce it into a line, if you can score something, it turns into a game. I like this kind of slightly poetic phrase a research agency about the email falling into your inbox like Tetris, and somebody said you can't bear to leave email unbolded, or bolded, right? You have to do, so it's kind of, the interface gives you a score in some ways, and more of our digital interfaces to our social situations, because we're trying to manage bigger and bigger scale ones, we give them smaller and smaller readouts, or we kind of bulwark them or abstract them into scores, reputations or unread numbers, etc., because we can't just look at it and deal with it because we're trying to deal with bigger and bigger networks. But that in turn turns it into playing games. Playing with reality is one that I really like. There's a book by Sutton Smith called there's a book by a guy which says a thing. and in that, it's Brian Sutton Smith, but I can't remember the name. But
the ambiguity of play.
That's it. Hey! This is, it's like a PowerPoint Jeopardy. and in that, one of his rhetorics is the play of fate. And the play of fate is kind of where you're embedded in this. There isn't an external dungeon master or super user other than the gods, and you're all embedded in the same system, and the play of fate is the play in that system, and that kind of, just in terms of seeing the meanies there, all of those sorts of things kind of comes in. But the play of fate is, as they say, it's kind of seductive and addictive, because you kind of believe that because you are all in the system, but what is outside the system is unreachable or implacable, or you have to sacrifice or pray to it or whatever, then inside it you start to have a very different situation than that we've just been describing. Let's get physical, dance revolution is basically the thing there. Again, the physical digital interaction starts to make reality scorable, and that means an increase in game-like or play-like behavior in some ways. Truly playful spaces is something that interests me, and coming back to space, is that we've gone through the last sort of 20 years of lots of our space, whether it's cultural space or commercial space, being really, they all have to be experience designs, and you can, it's an interpretive display. You know, press a button to be taken on the conveyor belt of life or something. You know, you have all of these things where the experience is kind of authored by somebody else for you to go through. And that's kind of changing, and there's more of a balance coming where people are pushing back on those prepackaged authored experiences and wanting to go into environments where there is some space for play themselves. So it's not going right back to the traditional kind of museum environment or those sorts of things, but it's creating a platform for play again. The perfect example of this, I think, is the Weather Project at the Tate Modern. I don't know if you saw that, where, what was his name? Eliasson? Thank you. He installed this giant sun and a giant mirror, and it was fantastic and wonderful as a piece of artwork. The thing that immediately people started to do, so the light, the sunlight, was a half circle, semicircle, and the mirror created this, the infinite space and the effect of it being like the kind of J.G. Ballard drowned world sun at the end. But what the mirror did immediately was create these groups which started spelling their names on the floor in the Tate model. And you went there day after day after day and you saw everybody do the same thing. Is they saw the amazing, awe-inspiring artwork, went, wow, that's amazing, that's incredible, I feel something, and then they started playing. They started making their names up and sort of going like this. And more people played with the mirror than probably any other piece of
Coca-Cola paid people to come every day and spell out Coca-Cola.
Yeah, it wouldn't take too much longer for that to happen. It's interesting how quickly...
It's coordination cost
right.
Problem.
We tried to come up with the definition of social software back when the phrase was first rolling around. One of the only satisfying definitions that we come up with was stuff that gets spammed. Because when there's social authenticity, the next thing that happens is the market is looking at it. Just in time situationless, I will go over because I'll probably get killed in the stream. Hacker placing, similarly. Reimagining the urban, similarly. Search and deploy is an interesting one in some ways. It's about the game between creating and finding, and how technology is changing that, and changing the speed at which people discover things and find things, and therefore changing the rate at which you can create a game in a space at some point. Mundane is new fun is kind of weirdly interesting, but and it has a Hello Kitty toaster on it. But this is kind of about arduous tasks, which now we don't aren't arduous, and how we bend them into leisure forms or play forms. So we used to have to create our own clothing to survive. Now we do it to express
ourselves.
The lawnmower. That's lawnmower racing. Very big in Britain. What else is interesting? I think this. This again might be obvious to you, but this is what we were talking about internally about this in terms of what's the difference between what we usually do and what we could do to work with social play and social playful situation. So the characteristics again from the literature which you seem more familiar with than myself. About the characteristics of the players being voluntary, unpredictable, and manageable. So it's an interesting about that unpredictable point and what was being shown in the last sort of 15 minutes about the action world stuff, about the strategies you can discern and the ones that you don't, and the agency that you have in those systems. And the legibility around all of those rules, and how it's difficult to you can't have a legible system without iteration in some ways. Sorry if this is already obvious and not interesting. So what we were talking about in terms of both our software and, well, mainly software really, and particularly kind of behaviors of software, was about kind of introducing unpredictability into network systems to extend their longevity in some way. And I really like the point about what happens if you know when it's going to end, and what does that do to? That's actually, in some ways, what creates play. You know it's not going to carry on forever, so you can do some outrageous things. You can see the edges of the system, but on the other hand, that means that you probably get a. You probably get a problem in that sooner. If you're designing for play, no. If you're designing for play, then you really, you want to keep it exciting. You want to keep it playful. You want to keep that play state. And so you want to create the longevity of that play state. You need the unpredictability. And you also, the interesting thing, which we almost got to, is what happens if people can communicate the rules between themselves rather than just the outcomes.
Right.
And what happens when you start to do that? And that's kind of a bit of a difference between a game and play for me in some ways. Play is more mutable and it changes over time, but it only changes over time through social contract that we're all still playing. So it's okay to change the rules. Because there aren't those outcomes on the individuals involved. But that was that one, and I just wanted to very, very quickly take you through another thing that I've done over the last year, and we've had some things which might be.
You showed the thing you wanted to play with?
Oh, okay. I can't if I'm not online.
Ah.
Give me
I'll explain it, and I'll send out the report. Send out the
email.
You want.
Or Mac PC.
So one of the things that we did out of this was we tried to, as I said, we try and make things to illustrate all of this nonsense PowerPoint. And we made a toy for. Does anybody have a Series 60 phone?
Yeah.
A what?
Series 60. A phone that runs Series 60.
We've got one in the ER. So
okay.
It is the driver.
Okay. So that you might be able to.
That was a quick one.
So we created a toy which runs on your phone but is connected to a web service because we wanted to try and illustrate some of the things we thought we'd learn. And it's called Twitcher. Follow the vote for leaving out the end bell. These things.
Thank you, Stuart Butterfish.
And it's basically Flickr for artificial life. So you have a toy. You have a toy in your phone which creates a garden which creatures visit, and creatures are delivered to your. To your garden via the network, and then you take pictures of them and you report back, and you write little things like you write little natural histories about what's happening and those sorts of things. The other part, the last part of it though, as well. And so if I have to log in. Is we wanted to try and it doesn't work on this browser.
What's that?
We wanted to create several levels of play. So there's a play that you can just have when you're using the toy on your device, which is very self-contained and very sort of just it's toy-like play. There's lots of kind of little activities in there which just give you little peanuts of endorphin of happiness versus play. Then there's the kind of web-based play, which is much more of a social play, which is the thing that might be interesting in terms of trading and those sorts of things. And we can't really experiment with that until we get lots and lots of people in there, which is why I'm starting to talk about it. And the last part of it is we've also got an API to it. So you can start to mess with it in ways you in different ways of expressing what goes on in there. So one interesting way of perhaps tying this thing, which might not be that relevant to what we've been talking about back, is what happens when I mean there's a very different view, so that abstraction of cooperation, you draw it as dots from 30,000 feet to when you have it situated in the room, you feel it. And what's the effect of how you experience those actions, those iterative actions, changed by how you visualize them? Both not just in terms of how you visualize them in a information visualization, but how you construct a model out of them, perceive them. And one thing that I think is interesting, or perhaps you can reach to from looking at some of the things that Web 2.0 type places are doing, is that they're perhaps getting you into the guts of them. They're giving you APIs in order for you to get more of a mental model about how you act in that system. To be sure, if you get into those places, you have to be, you're an expert already in some ways, and you know how to prod those things around. But it interests me to think about what privileges you give people about how you see those systems and how that feeds back on how they play. So if you have the correct phone, or you just want to play with this, then I can give you the
Send the URL.
Yeah, I can give you the username and password. And if there's anything that I can do or provide, or probably very little, or if you have any questions, then please send them to me. I'm Clay, is my email address. Thank you very much for letting me sit in. It's been really, really fun. One thing from the architectural perspective again is there's been lots and lots written in. There was lots and lots written in the 70s and 80s about the effect of space on social cooperation, particularly in offices. And this was pre. This is my final rant, but this was pre information technology in some ways. So in the 1970s, you had lots of Germans writing about this. My favourite word in the world, I think, Bürogewandschaft, which is office landscape, and how that affects institutional knowledge and interactions. And then came, rise of information technology and all the rest of it. But now we're at a time when people are talking about space again, because the capital cost of investing in the information technology is bigger and more difficult than the capital cost of architecture. So architecture is a cheap way out of your knowledge management problems now, which is twisted. But smart architects information design, interaction designers are starting to look at the overlap, of course, between digital and real worlds. And I hope that you get to that at some point. And the physical dimension, particularly when you're talking about what we do at Nokia, is really important.
Given the subject of papers, I'm sure I'm sitting on a lot of that, because almost every group here has some combination of real world plus virtual space. Okay, thank you.
Well, thanks for letting
me. Yes.
I was wondering, who are your audiences for this thing?
Who is my audience?
Yeah. Is it children and dogs?
No. We didn't have a thought about audience, but we did have a thought about what was responsible to do. So there are certain things that you, there are certain legislative instruments which mean that you don't do things, and they're also trying to be a good person. So we're limiting it to over 16s. But this is that's something we need to talk to my wife about, actually. But the audience for this is not a public audience, so we're trying to get about 200 people in it or something. It's a beta, so in the old fashioned sense, but it's not ready. It's not real.
Not that we launched it, but we don't want
it.
I'm
traditional like that. So while I'd like lots, I need to. It hasn't got an audience yet. It's just an experiment in trying to do some things differently than we do here at the moment. But it's good. My wife is at the moment. She's doing a project with Nesta in the UK, which is a government body, and looking at trying to do safe knowledge communities for kids.
My husband is doing something with them.
Okay, well they let us never meet because they'll leave us free. Anyway, in terms of these themes of play and safety and iteration and learning the rules and learning the social facts, you know, it's interesting what digital systems both take away and give you in those situations. I think it's becoming harder to find what they give you in some ways.
There's a lot more downside than
I
anticipated 10 years ago.
All right, okay, thank you very much. Next time we'll meet is the 14th, not the 7th. In the syllabus, there are three readings, and I am only going to give two of them. So essentially, the one that's listed as the handout is the one I'm not assigning. Go to the two that are listed as URLs and read those. I'm also going to ask you, as preparation for the next class, not as an assignment that you'll turn into me, but as background, to, in the next 2 weeks, as you're just going and doing other things, I'm going to ask you to document 5 group situations, and I don't mean long documentation. Just write down 5 situations you observe in your life. They can be founding dilemmas, they can be coordination dilemmas, getting a group of people to decide what movie to see, getting a group of people to decide whether or not to get together and form a band, arranging groups in a class. They can be founding dilemmas, coordination dilemmas, they can be governance dilemmas, they can be decision making. I'll send out an email detailing that, but I just want you to come in with a list of things you've observed, because that will form some of the background of the discussion in the next class. Thank you all. See you on the 14th of October.
What?
I should have had to sign away.